In life, you've got to own your life. You've got to take accountability. You can't outsource critical decisions to other people. If I want to be successful professionally, as a person, whatever the definition is, I've got to take full and total accountability. I'm almost glad, Sarah, that I didn't summit every mountain on my first attempt, because I think I learned more about the requirements for success from failing on these mountains and probably what I did from summiting these mountains.
My name is Sarah Kumalo, a businesswoman, a mother, and an award-winning mountaineer. I know what it feels like when the ground shakes beneath you. 3 times, Mount Everest sent me back down through avalanche, earthquake, and injury. 3 times, the world told me to quit. I kept going, and on the 4th attempt, I stood on the summit. Most would call the earlier attempts failure, but I learned something different. The shift is not the disruption. The shift is the lesson. It's not the fall that defines you, but the rise. Because true failure only happens when you stop taking the next step. In when shift happens, we explore the moments that break us and how they build us. Take a breath. The air is thin up here, and the views are worth it. Welcome to the summit journey. Let's go higher. Welcome to When Shift Happens. My story involves 4 attempts on Everest. Today, my guest, fellow South African mountaineer and psychologist Louis Castens, shares a deeply similar narrative, but with a different mountain, the formidable Lhotse. Louis has successfully summited the 7 summits, including Everest, and conquered 4 of the world's 8,000-meter peaks. Yet, his battle with Lhotse defines his persistence. He was turned back not once, but twice, in 2014 and 2015, before finally conquering Lhotse in 2018. That persistence is the bedrock of his professional life. As a PhD executive, Louis recently faced an equally intense challenge, scaling up. He moved from a smaller, agile firm to a massive global consulting firm, a jump that requires adapting to giant systems and a new kind of risk. How do you summon the mental fortitude for both the mountain and the corporate scale-up? And what happens when a father who navigates global strategies suddenly finds the rules at home changed, his children grown up, and navigating their own adult life? In this episode, we explore the inner climb, the psychological strategies Louis uses to master scaling, systematic change, and persistence in the face of profound professional and personal shifts. Louis, thank you for joining me. And to start this off, I would like you to maybe introduce yourself in your own words, especially some of the work that you've done that is to do with shifting, changing, and so forth that we know life throws at us.
Good morning, Sarah, and great to be here, and thanks for the invitation. And I look forward to this conversation and hopefully sharing some insights based on my own experience. So I guess some people look at me and say I've had a totally unfocused career because I started in, you know, I started with a BCom and ended up with a PhD in org psychology, where I worked on stress management and cognitive behavioral therapies. And then I worked in big corporates, and then I went to small entrepreneurial consulting firms. And then I went to industry and worked in different countries in Africa. But the thread of my career has always been business performance improvement. So both in terms of the organization improving performance, and then where my real passion is focusing on the human element in business performance improvement. I'm very lucky to both enjoy the data side of business improvement and the quants and all of those things. But I particularly feel encouraged in my career when I work with people and helping them with a change process. And that's also where my mountaineering comes in, which, as you know, I've been doing for 25 years now, and did the 7 summits and 4 8,000-meter peaks. But the lessons I've learned for myself out of those help me also with my career. So in essence, how I like to position myself is I like to make things better.
Amazing. That's what evolution is all about. It's adapting. So, Louis, your story with Lhotse mirrors mine with Everest, you know, the heartbreak of being turned back twice and finally reaching the summit in 2018. What kept you going after those early attempts, which one would look at as failures? And what did that persistence teach you about yourself and both as a mountaineer as well as a professional executive?
Sarah, so in 2014, it was my first attempt on Lhotse. And I remember heading into the ice fall at about 6:45 that morning, and I wanted to go and do some training. And I was a friend of mine, and we said, we just want to go halfway up the Khumbu ice fall to do some training. And then that terrible accident happened with in the Khumbu ice fall with the serac coming off that shoulder. And they closed the mountain, right? So we couldn't climb.
Yeah.
And I had to deal with that and ask myself, how important was Lhotse for me? Because it's not that I gave the mountain my best shot. I was the recipient of circumstances beyond my control. And I think when I left Lhotse in 2014, and I thought to myself, well, you know, Lhotse is the fourth highest in the world, but it's not that critical for me to summit Lhotse. There's other 8,000 meter peaks to do. But when I got back home and I thought, and I read again about Lhotse, and I thought about, I didn't, you know, when I give a mountain my best shot and I don't summit, I'm okay with that. But when I don't summit, and it's because of these circumstances, I want to go back. So I went back in 2015 and climbed well. I think that's when I met you, right? In 2015, you were doing Everest. And I remember we were between camps 1 and 2. And I remember saying to one of my friends, I said, geez, today, this time this expedition is going well. And I'm not exaggerating. Half an hour later, the earthquake struck, right? That led to 9,000 people losing their lives.
Yeah.
We then said, okay, now there's a crisis. We got back to camp 2, couldn't climb, had to be choppered off the mountain, route through the ice fall, collapsed. Terrible getting back to base camp. And I look at where my tent was supposed to be, base camp, the avalanche of Pumori destroyed all of that, right? And that hit me profoundly because my own experience of being caught on in the Western Khum, you know, avalanche coming off Nuptse and off Everest, right? And luckily I was between the two. And then kind of Lhotse disappeared for me. So that was 2014, 2015. I thought, it's not for me, right? But then around about 2017, I believe we need to set really big goals in life, right? Big goals that scare you. And I remember looking at Lhotse from the summit of Everest in 2010. And you look at that Lhotse Kulwa, and I thought to myself in 2010, that's tough. That's a tough thing to climb. And when I went back in 2018 and at that stage, more of an independent climber using logistics, but me and a Sherpa, and I summited. And I got back down the mountain and I thought to myself, I'm really pleased that I went back for my third attempt on Lhotse, right? Because it showed at a practical level what I do in terms of setting big goals. In my work, I talk about, whether it's business performance improvement or individuals, I talk about set big goals. A big goal is something that motivates you in the face of failure. So my biggest learning from Lhotse was, I think I have the ability to set big goals for me. And the proof is that I went back a third time to summit that mountain after my two earlier failures. So what kept me going back? I guess the significance of the goal and knowing how hard I have to work to get to that goal.
Interesting. I was actually there both 2014 and 2015, but of course I met you in 2015. Interesting that you were also caught between Camp 1 and 2, which is where the earthquake also caught me. But I love your view of why going back in 2015. For most people, turning back feels like failure. But on the mountain and in leadership, it often is survival and wisdom. As a psychologist, how do you process that moment when you decide not to push further? What happens mentally in that space between courage and restraint?
So maybe I must just stay back a little bit here and talk about Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain
in South America.
South America, one of the seven summits. And Sarah, as you know, as mountaineers, we are the most creative in the world to find excuses when we don't summit, right?
Of course.
And
reframing, we call it.
We reframe, right? So I went to Aconcagua after I've successfully summited Kilimanjaro and Mont Blanc. And I didn't work particularly hard for those two summits. Yeah. You know, I was kind of took those in my stride, right?
Yeah.
But I suffered on both mountains because I wasn't well prepared. And I remember I summited Kilimanjaro the first time and I thought to myself, this is it. I'm done with climbing. I don't like it. It's not for me. And flying back, the in-flight magazine had an article about Aconcagua. And I thought to myself, how difficult can it be? You know, I've tried two mountains. I summited two mountains. Well, I went to Aconcagua and I didn't summit the first time. And then when I came back, you know, now I need to have some credibility, right? So it was all about, no, we had really bad weather. Right.
Yeah.
Went back the second time, didn't make it. Now, this time, my guide got sick. But a profound thing happened to me, Sarah, and I'm very happy to talk about that, which is I had to look at myself in the mirror and realize that I was the problem.
Wow.
The reason why I wasn't summiting Aconcagua wasn't because of weather or because of my guide being sick or whatever. It's simply the fact that I didn't own my climb. I didn't take accountability for my goal. Now, we did have bad weather, and my guide did get sick. But I could have, had I owned my climb, had I taken accountability instead of almost outsourcing decisions to guides and people, maybe I would have had a different outcome the first two attempts. And I remember realizing that in life, you've got to own your life. You've got to take accountability. You can't outsource critical decisions to other people. And I went back to Aconcagua and I summited the mountain twice since that profound insight that if I want to climb mountains, if I want to be successful professionally as a person, whatever the definition is, I've got to take full and total accountability. Fast forward to turning around on Mount Everest in 2009. I turned around 400 meters from the summit. I remember at the time that I turned around, and again, you know, I had a bit of a stomach bug the entire expedition, but I climbed well. But I remember getting to the balcony, and I thought to myself, I really feel strong enough to summit. I'm not convinced about feeling strong enough to come down. And I turned around at 8:04. At that stage, Discovery Channel was making a program, and I remember getting back to Camp 2 and being interviewed by Discovery, and they asked me, will you come back to Everest? And I said, no, because I gave this mountain my best shot. Well, 30 minutes after leaving base camp, I said to my guide, I said, I'm coming back next year. So I've turned around on mountains. I'm almost glad, Sarah, that I didn't summit every mountain in my first attempt, because I think I learned more about the requirements for success from failing on these mountains. And probably what I did from summiting these mountains. So I don't go and climb now not to summit, right?
Yeah.
I go to summit. But
of course,
when you own a climb, which is what I do, and I take accountability for my decisions, and I choose to turn around, and I do it for good reason, I learn a lot from that.
Absolutely. You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I believe that I'm a different leader, a different person, because I attempted Everest 4 times.
Yeah.
As an overachiever, you get up there and you think, I've got this. But the mountain humbled me in more ways than I could ever imagine. It's helped me realize that nobody gets to the top alone. And many other leadership lessons that I hold dearly that have really changed who I am and how I look at leadership and life. So I couldn't agree with you more. Let's move away from the mountains now, but I know we're going to go back there because it's just got so much to teach us as individuals and as leaders as well. You recently made a major transition from a smaller agile firm to a global consulting giant. What were the biggest psychological adjustments you had to make to stay true to yourself in such a massive system?
Sarah, yes. So move from a firm of 700 people globally to a massive global giant in consulting of 780,000 people, I think, right?
Yeah.
The first thing that it's kind of a life principle I have, which I try to teach my kids. And that principle is not to live in the past. That is my number one. It's arguably for me one of the 3 to 4 to 5 key principles that I live my life by. It's not a value, right? It's a principle. So when any change happens, the first thing I do is not to fall back in missing what the past held for me. And I mentioned to you earlier this morning, a good friend of mine, one day when I asked him, and he's doing executive coaching, and I asked him, I said to him, what's the single most important thing you have heard in your 25 years of coaching executives and leaders? He said, the number one thing is that so many people talk about the glorious past instead of the glorious future. So this change that happened, small firm to a big firm, yes, there are profound changes. Why I like the world of consulting, it's ultimately about results and impact. And in this bigger firm, given the breadth of skills, capabilities, tools, it's good for the way I service my clients. So I embrace that. It's good for my clients. It's a big firm, so I need to adapt. And I need to adapt my behaviors to these realities. Yeah. As a one man, you know, I can't change the systems and the culture of a firm that size. Mm-hmm. What I can do is the second thing that I believe in life, build my networks. And through building my networks, learn to navigate change. You made the point earlier, you don't summit a mountain alone. And I believe you don't succeed in business alone. And it's often these informal networks that help you to succeed. So one of the biggest things I have gained in this new environment is informal networks that I can tap into at very short notice that help me to do a better job servicing the range of needs of my clients. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying change is easy. And I don't want to fall into almost like, forgive me, you know, tacky sayings like, oh, you know, life is about choices.
Yeah.
That's a bit simplistic for me.
Yeah.
But when you are confronted with a big change like this, I'm going to talk about the change relationship with my children. Take the best of the past, right? But don't live in the past. There's a fundamental difference. It's like risk. You can either understand risk or you accept risk. Two fundamentally different things. I think we often confuse understanding risk with accepting the risk. So for me, we're busy being integrated into this big firm. And quite frankly, and I said to a colleague yesterday who asked me, how do I find this? And I said, there's tough days, but overall, it's an exciting era for me. Because one of the things I fear the most is to stagnate.
Exactly.
I fear stagnation.
Yeah.
So whenever anything, literally anything comes across my path where I have a choice to adapt or not, I embrace that. As hard as it can be, because if you don't, you're going to stagnate. When you stagnate, it leads to mediocrity.
Yes.
And mediocrity for me is more dangerous than the most dangerous mountain in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, when I was listening to you just now, one of the things that one could relate to is you walking with your, or climbing with your Sherpa. He says the worst thing we can do is just stand still. Even if it's a half a step, let's take
half
it.
A step.
You know, the coldest I measured on Everest was minus 42 at Camp 4.
Yes.
You can't afford to stand still.
No.
You need to keep moving, and which is why one of my favorite, it's not a saying, is keep stepping. It's a slogan that I hold very dear to me. So, Louis, both the mountain and the corporate world can be unforgiving, you know, when making a decision on anything. And if you make a wrong decision on the mountain, you know, you may remain part of the mountain. In corporate, you may lose money. How do you train your mind and those you lead to perform under pressure and uncertainty without losing perspective or compassion?
I like the way you frame the question.
Yeah.
Just stepping back again to mountains. I love mountains because mountains...
Yes.
It's not only for me a practical laboratory for life, but to succeed on a mountain is what you need to succeed in life. So number one for me is always preparation, right?
Mm.
So when I train for an 8,000-meter peak, my preparation is intense. Mm. It comes with choices and trade-offs. And when I've got a training program and I need to train, I train. As an example, I was training for Makalu.
Yes.
But I went for a run and I fell and I twisted my ankle. So I needed to cycle in my study. And my training program from Training Peaks in the US was on 31 December of that year, I need to do a 3-hour stationary bike ride.
Mm.
So 31st of December, when everybody else is having a ride, I'm sitting on my bike cycling. That was my preparation. Mm. So Sarah, number one for me is always preparation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I truly over-prepare for mountains. When I need to do a piece of work for a client or an exco presentation, I over-prepare. Mm-hmm. I don't like being under-prepared. I don't believe in this thing that where you just wing things. I don't wing it. Mm-hmm. I'm prepared. I'm over-prepared. As far as I can, different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do an exco presentation. Do I know if everybody's aligned with my message? Have I spoken to them? What mm-hmm. if the chief client doesn't like my message? How do I manage those things?
Mm-hmm.
So number one for me to the way I lead is, for me, my team's preparation. You don't go home until the job is done. I think that's a critical thing.
Yep.
My entire career, I've tried to manage my teams in a way that weekends is theirs. And I think I've mostly stayed true to that, because that is how my team members and those that I lead, that's how they recharge their batteries. And I also believe that if you allow your teams that freedom of, this is now the weekend, I can recharge my batteries. I don't need to worry about getting a WhatsApp from Louis or somebody.
Mm.
I think that helps to build a culture of compassion. Compassion mm. is not just words.
Yeah.
It's actions and behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
I do expect a lot from those that I lead.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in consulting now. I was a C-suite executive in big firms.
Mm-hmm.
I always expect a lot. I expect the highest standards. Get the job done. Be well prepared. Do what you're getting paid to do. But then you go home and you enjoy your time with your loved ones. And then you mm-hmm. come back Monday morning and you're fully charged and you can work. At times it has happened where my principals will call me or my mm-hmm. bosses will call me every weekend. That's life. It
yeah.
happens,
yeah.
right? But when there's enough goodwill where they've left, my bosses left me alone
yeah.
for a while, right? Yeah. Then there's goodwill when somebody calls me at 4 o'clock on a Sunday and say, listen, can you help me get this done by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning? Of mm-hmm. course there's goodwill. So I just believe, Sarah, that you lead through example, you know, you just lead through example and you lead through wisdom and perspective.
Mm.
You lead with a level of compassion for other people.
Mm.
And that's the eternal journey for me, because I really don't think anybody gets it fully right all the time.
Mm. Mm. Louis, do you articulate it to your teams to say, I expect more from you? Or do you lead by example in terms of expecting more for yourself? And it's so obvious to the team that they give you extra.
It's at a primary level, it's the latter. Let's take mountaineering again. I remember people asking me after I summited Mount Everest and did the 7 summits. And then I went back climbing again. People said to me, but why? Mm-hmm. You've summited Everest. I said, but guys, my goal is not to just summit Everest. My goal is I want to be a world-class 8,000-meter mountaineer.
Mm.
That's what I want to do, which mm. means that it's an eternal journey for me. As a leader, it's exactly the same. When we're going through a crunch time and my team must work until 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, I don't go home at 6 o'clock. You don't. That's not leading by example. That's leading through autocracy. Now, again, perspective matters. There are times when I feel the work is done, I can go home. And yeah, the team, you want to stay and you want to go through the stuff again, you can do that. But you've got to be in the trenches, Sarah. You've mm-hmm. got to be in the trenches with your team. A leader who's not in the trenches and a leader who sits in the corner office all day
mm-hmm.
and sends emails, that's not leading. That's managing. And that's good. You need that.
Yeah.
I think I'm a far better leader than a manager. And I enjoy leadership. But those are the principles for me. You prepare. Mm-hmm. You're in the trenches with your team. You leave them alone over weekends. You show them that you yourself set the highest of standards, and you're always striving for more. You're never satisfied. Those are the kind of, for me, the timeless principles in my leadership style.
Amazing. Thank you for that, Louis. So on the mountain, the purpose is simple. You get up and you really must come down safely, right? But in corporate life, purpose can get lost in the matrix and systems and politics, which, you know, whether we say they are there or not, they are there, corporate politics. How do you reconnect with meaning and personal purpose when life feels overly complex or disconnected from your core values as a leader?
That's a profound question. I remember before I joined the smaller firm, which is now 4.5 years ago, the person who was running the firm locally in Africa or in Johannesburg at that time, mm-hmm. I worked with him many years ago in another firm. I remember we were at an event and he invited me to the event. And he said to the audience, which is the other consultant, he said, "You really have to love what we do. If you work for us, you have to love what we do."
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me, right? Mm-hmm. If you love what you do, it will show.
Yes.
Right? There are times when it's corporate, right? There's deadlines. There's politics. You know, politics is everywhere. But I have found that, as I said earlier, I don't think I'm a good manager, right? I think I'm a better leader than a manager. To take teams with me on a journey towards an outcome, to take teams with me where I lead by example, where we do what we love. And in our consulting firm, even though we're part of a bigger firm now, what do? Again, one of my superiors in the smaller firm always talk about, we help make businesses better. And I like that framing. So for me, true to my values, in my business life, my professional life, I love what I do. And secondly, it's meaningful for me that I love what I do. Mm-hmm. I have a saying that I'm not sure if I came up with it, but I probably didn't. Oh. But I have this thing that says, when a job feels like a job, you're in the wrong job. That's me. When a job feels like a job, I'm in the wrong job. Mm-hmm. And I've been so fortunate in my career that probably everywhere that I worked, I worked there because I wanted to. And I liked working there. I liked living there. For me, it's not about the position that I have. It's not about the power. It's about impact. Money is an outcome. It's a consequence. Power is a consequence. It's about impact. And that's how I stay true to my values. I love what I do, climbing a mountain and my professional life. I lead better than what I manage. And it's all about having an impact. And that's how I stay true to my values.
I love that. I didn't start off in corporate like that, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately. I kind of stumbled into it after losing my older sister and going through, whether it was a midlife crisis, just trying to find me. I found myself in a position where I didn't get into a company because they were going to pay me more, but because I aligned to what they were trying to achieve. Always about making people's lives better. People that were me yesterday, if I can make their lives just a tiny weeny better, I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
And it's not something that we all start with. I mean, you're coming from the township. All you want is, I want to get into the suburbs. I want a car. So the last thing is that I want to make my neighbor's life better. And that's the honest truth. And somewhere along the way, you kind of change that. And I don't know if that is different from a Louis who's a teenager, goes into varsity and goes into corporate the first time. Did you always have that mindset?
I think I've always had a mindset, Sarah, of being independent and kind of figuring things out.
Yeah.
My dad was a mine worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I attended something like 14 different schools.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
In grade 4, I think I attended 3 different schools in 1 year. But this taught me to be resilient.
Mm.
Right? Mm. It taught me when I get to a new school, mm-hmm. after my dad took me out of my current school after 2 months or 3 months, and I go to a new school, you need to adapt. You can't think back to all your friends that you left behind in the other school. You need to make new friends. You need to adapt. So this thing about constant adaptation, figuring things out for myself, being resilient, taking charge of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has been part of me from whenever I can remember. It has shaped me in terms of So that experience of attending so many schools, that experience of I had to adapt, that need, that urgency of in those days, right? So you get to a new school, I needed to write down all the notes from, I need to borrow somebody's book, and I needed to write down all the notes to catch up. Well, you know, that was a form of studying in any case. So people ask me, you know, how do you feel about having been in 14 schools? Good. I feel good about it. It's the card that was dealt.
Yeah.
I just had to play the card. It's the ball that was bowled. I had to bat the ball. So that's been part of my life, Sarah. This thing about, and that's why I started this conversation with you about taking accountability and taking charge.
Absolutely.
And don't outsource your life to other people. Don't outsource your life to a boss or to an organization. Serve the organization. Servant leadership. But don't outsource your life. And I've never done that. Not from when I can remember my very first school or, you know, my first recollection as a child at 4 or 5 years old. You can't do that. I don't do that.
Sounds like you've had more shifts than many people. You've spoken about a new kind of shift when I spoke to you last week. As a father, watching your children grow into their own lives, how has that transition changed the way you understand leadership, letting go and redefining success beyond career and summit?
I think you've given the answer. It's about letting go, Sarah.
Yeah.
When my children was at school, it was a relationship of dependency. And quite frankly, I liked it. I liked that my kids would come to me and say, Dad, you know, at that time I need a, please buy me an iTunes app.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And there was almost like this constant looking up at me as the father. I remember when I summited Manaslu and we got back and we'd go out for dinner. My kids, they were like, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 8 or whatever. I've got twin boys. We'd go to a restaurant and they would just tell everybody, hey, you know, my dad summited Manaslu, as if anybody cared. Your restaurant, nobody cares that you summited, but they cared, right?
They cared.
Now they grown-ups, right? Legally, they're adults. They're at university. And the relationship has changed. One where it was the dependency and almost like my dad's my hero.
Yeah.
Which is good for me, right?
I want to be your ego.
It's good for my ego. It's an entire, and I had to think very deeply about it because I fell into the trap of missing what that was.
Yeah.
Right? And then you realize, but it's a, you know, again, I need to adapt because my children are now building their lives. They're studying. They're making plans for their future.
Yeah.
Right? And I want to be part of that future. But then I need to redefine the relationship. And it's a lot more one of equals rather than dependency. And when I sit there over weekends and, you know, I miss my kids and they are out in it. Some 21st or they're out with their friends or they're playing golf or whatever. And I say, geez, you know, the Springboks are playing and I want to watch the test with you. Sorry, Dad, you know, we've got a party tonight. You need to think about how you want to, what kind of father you want to be. And similar to when I said to you, Sarah, that ever since I can remember as a kid, how I had to adapt with my father moving between towns as a mine worker and contract worker. Similarly for me as a father, it's a principle of how I brought my kids up. I've never had this thing about thou shalt. You know, when psychologists would come to the school and say, listen, don't give your kids cell phones before the age of 12, for example. If I want to give my kids cell phones at 10, I would do it. I wouldn't put a limit on screen time. But I would always talk about impact, which is why impact is so important for me in my life and in my professional life. And the impact was, boys, you want a phone? Here's a phone. You know, of course, if I catch you at 3 o'clock in the morning on the phone, there's going to be a problem. But what I don't want to see is that your academic results dip. And the understanding with my children growing up was always, I will deliver, but you deliver to me. That means academic results. And now, it's almost similar where, boys, you are studying, you're building your careers. We now need to talk about what your life What do you want to do after you completed your studies? And what's nice to see is how the relationship shifted from almost the where I was the hero growing up through to now, Dad, I need to talk to you about this subject in my curriculum, whether you think I should take it or not. And it's been profound for me, that shift, Sarah, from children, my children, and me being the father figure to equals.
Almost equals,
and
yeah.
I embrace that. It's a wonderfully refreshing shift in my relationship with my children. And when I get home and, you know, we equals, I love that. And that works for me and it works for my children. Might not work for other people. It works for us.
It's actually interesting. I suppose you as a psychologist, maybe you've got the formula. I'm figuring that out because just last month, my 22-year-old son was saying to me, "Oh, I like this, Mom. We can kind of talk about anything. You sound like my friend." It's like, "Oh, hello, my dog." I'm like, "Not your dog." Says, "Mom, come on." I'm like, "You're my friend." And I sat there and I'm thinking, my goodness, this, I can't reprimand that. And it's something that I guess as parents, especially as an African parent, we need to kind of look at and see how we shift with that change in relationship. Having said that, when shift happens in your life, whether it's on the slopes of the mountain like Lotse or in the boardroom, what's your first inner response? Do you fight it? Do you embrace it? Or do you pause to understand it?
Of course, it depends on circumstances, right? In 2015, my second attempt on Lotse, and when the earthquake happened, and I've got an avalanche coming off Nuptse on the right and Everest on the left, that's survival, right? Yeah. In that moment, there's no time to embrace or pause and reflect, right? Because the situation demands an immediate response from you. But that's not the typical situation that we go through in life. I think I'm a bit of a pause and reflect kind of person. Some people have called me impulsive, and I have made impulsive decisions in the past. And I think where I'm now in my growth as a human being, I'm definitely in the pause and reflect phase, where I try to make good decisions and wise decisions rather than impulsive, knee-jerk kind of things. I haven't always been the pause and reflect kind of person. That's where I'm now. And the beauty for me of life is, and again, you know, there's, of course, there's outliers, but mostly is we can evolve if we choose that. We can choose to grow or we can choose to stagnate. And neither one is right or wrong. It's a personal choice. And I'm just very pleased that if I look at my entire life, it has been this thing of adaptation, resilience, making friends, working hard, failing, some successes. But I do hope that the legacy that I will leave in both professional life and personal life is when if people can just say, I always seek to be better.
Amazing. Wow. Thank you for that. And now for our last and signature question, because we all know that shift always happens. We are born, we can hardly do anything for ourselves. Then we're crawling, suddenly we're walking, and now in school, then we need to fend for ourselves, and then we need to look after other people as life throws things at us. So shift does really happen. When shift happened in your life, what did it teach you about who Louis really is and who he's becoming?
Indeed, a signature question. So, Sarah, shift has happened throughout my life. What that has taught me is I somehow managed to cope with these things. And I don't think that I've ever been a net negative impact anywhere in my life. And looking back at this, what it taught me about me is I think I have a very strong sense of adapting to change. I think I'm really good at not fearing what's on my path. And I literally don't. And one of the things that Everest taught me is it made me fearless, right? It made me fearless.
Scary.
But it also, I think your question, what did it teach me about Louis, about me, is I do think I'm a net contributor to people and a net contributor to the world and a net contributor to society. There's this dichotomy. People talk about you're either a taker or a giver.
Mm.
I think I'm a giver. And that's what it taught me is, you know, and like all of us, life throws curveballs, unexpected curveballs. And life is full of surprises.
Oh, it is indeed.
Life is full of surprises, good surprises and bad surprises. But I think I can cope with these things. There might have been, let's say, a bad surprise where for a period I suffered and I struggled. But I somehow can lift myself up and I can survive and I can contribute and I can work and I can be the father for my children that I know they need where they are in their own evolution today. And I can make a contribution at work and I can make an impact to my clients. And maybe, Sarah, if there's the one thing he taught me ultimately is I'm resilient and I'm fearless. Not reckless, I'm fearless.
I love that. Mountains, yeah, do make us feel like we are invincible. But at the same time, it can make us fly without having any support system sometimes because we think we can, which is why I find the answer that I think it's George Mallory, even Sayilari gave when say, why climb Everest? He says, because it's there and because we can. So Louis, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your absolute truth with me and the audience.
Excellent questions. Huh? I enjoyed this.
Thank you so much, Louis. And to you, the listeners, I hope you can feel the thin air that we are at in the death zone as we go through this conversation. Remember this, your greatest view isn't behind you. It lies just beyond your hardest climb. As you can tell, Louis was talking about, don't live in the past, live for the future. The shift has happened. The question is no longer why did it happen, but who you become because of it. Don't wait for permission to begin your ascent. Don't let fear silence your potential. Seize the lesson. Own the step. Command the future. You've been listening to When Shift Happens with me, Sarah Kumalo. Now begin your climb, one step at a time, and keep stepping higher and higher. If you would like to explore some of the lessons and tools we spoke about today, you'll find them in the show notes. If today's conversation spoke to you, share it with someone that's facing their own climb. Together, we are rising, one shift at a time. When Shift Happens is a Jackpod original podcast by Jacaranda FM. Let's go higher.